are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, June 13th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Assistant Professor of History at Princeton University, Matthew Karp, on the vast Southern Empire. Also on the program today, Republican Senate about to agree to secret repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act. Meanwhile, Trump wants to fire Mueller, and his personal lawyer is bragging that he got Preet-Bharara fired. Results should come in today of the Virginia gubernatorial primary. Tom Perriello running in that one. Jeff Sessions, slated to testify today, 2 p.m.
I'm coming.
Department of Justice says Donald Trump can accept payments from foreign governments.
It's good.
It's not illegal. I don't know why Mueller's even investigating it anymore.
Yeah, what's Mueller doing?
Russian hackers supposedly and reportedly breached 39 states' election rolls, more than previously reported. Meanwhile,
this is ridiculous.
The Senate agrees on more Russia sanctions, and reportedly, that's why the Democrats don't want to gum up the works in the Senate. Bipartisanship.
That is so infuriating.
All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. That last point is true, folks. Let me rephrase that. That last point that Senate Democrats reportedly did not want to gum up the works. And the way they would gum up the works is this. They withhold unanimous consent. There's a lot of things that the Senate does that involves unanimous consent from a procedural ground. And you, as a member of a committee or as the Senate as a whole, can slow things down. You can't stop them, but you can slow them down. And what is the value of slowing them down? There is no way. Now, understand, it's being reported now that the Republicans in the Senate have more or less come to an agreement on a bill. It's going to go to the CBO within the next couple of days. Nobody's sure about this because it's all been done in secret. There are some who have speculated the reason why we're hearing conservatives in the Senate complain is because a bill has been basically settled upon. They have already set it up procedurally so that this will be fast-tracked. There will be no opportunity for committees to deal with it at all. There will be no hearings on this bill. Yesterday, I think Michael played a clip from Claire McCaskill where she spoke in sort of incredulously that there was going to be no hearings on this bill. And Mitch McConnell, again, has successfully ushered this bill through the Senate, pretending all the while that there was nothing going to, we couldn't get anything through. There has been very little media coverage on this because, of course, it is all about the fact that the president is a criminal, which is newsworthy.
It's also true.
And that his advisors are full of liars. But Chris Murphy, senator from Connecticut. And I'll tell you why I'm heartened by this just a little bit anyways. He tweeted out, my advice today. This was, of course, yesterday. Or no, this is this morning. My advice today, focus 10% of your attention / outrage on Sessions' testimony. 90% on the secret health care bill that is speeding to a vote. The fact is that the Democrats could gum up the works. And what would that do? That would only basically push it till after the July 4th recess, right? They're going to need a couple of days to push it. If you were to gum up the works by 2 weeks, you'd push it past the July 4th recess. You would give a chance to rebuild because much of it is dissipated. You see all sorts of things that it used to be, you know, offices were getting flooded by calls. But by having no town halls, by keeping it secret, the debates, they have effectively diminished the ire that is pointed at them in terms of healthcare. You need to give it time to get people to ramp back up. This is from Jeff Stein on Vox. He tweeted this out. I guess he tweeted this out. This was 2 days ago, or yesterday, I should say. Excuse me, at 6 p.m. Senate Democrats believe escalating by using nuclear option, that is basically when you force a vote on everything instead of unanimous consent, over the AHCA would unify the Republicans and make the AHCA more likely. From an aide on background, if Democrats tried to bring the Senate to a halt, boycotting Murkowski's Energy Committee hearing or Senator Collins' Aging Committee hearing, for example, that would harden Republicans' resolve and they'd be that much closer to passing Trump care anyway. Boycotting hearings or withholding consent, what's going to do is just unite them. So they say, man, these Democrats are impossible. This is so shocking that an aide could believe this at this point. The idea is if we're nice, we have a better chance of them saying, I don't want to do this. First of all, I have no doubt that there are sort of like people's personal feelings get involved in this all the time. I think we would all be shocked to realize how much and how petty this stuff is when it comes to senators. But there is zero evidence that you can rely on Republicans to do the right thing. Even if you actually believe that Susan Collins or Murkowski think it's the wrong thing to do to take away health care from their constituents, there is only one thing that will influence them, and that is public pressure. Enormous public pressure. And it is very unlikely that you will get enormous public pressure if there is not an opportunity for people to mobilize around knowing what's in this bill, because there's no way to report on it. I mean, just I, who have no sensitivity to ratings. You know, we're doing another, today we're doing a, it's a fascinating book on the South's notion of foreign policy in the years prior to the Civil War. Okay? I, who have no problem talking about stuff that is not going to generate a lot of attention, I am still talking about this only as a third order story, right? Deep background on what a aide says about why they're not going to gum up the works to slow things down in the Senate. So there's a couple of extra weeks so that after the CBO score, there may be an opportunity for people to rally against this. It's an effective strategy the Republicans are pursuing because there's no way to communicate what's going on in a way that would motivate people, because there's no bill that we're aware of, which is why the time, The timing is so important. Slowing this down is so important. There's nothing as important as this. There's nothing. So if you live in a Republican, in a state with a Republican senator, you call them and you say, don't vote for this. Don't vote for this. Because we know that it will destroy pre-existing conditions. You can say everybody's got to offer pre-existing condition insurance. But if you also say we're going to rejigger the community rating system in such a way you can get a waiver so that pre-existing health insurance, if you have a pre-existing condition, health insurance is going to cost you 5, 6, 10 times more. That's not really. It's only going to be cost prohibitive, not statutorily prohibitive. You call your senator right now. If you have to turn off the show, do it. Call your senator. Google what the Senate number is, 202. And if you live in a, if you have a Democratic senator, you call them and you tell them, we need more time to rally. You got to gum up the works. That's what you got to do. Play a clip of, we'll do that clip of what's his face in a second, but.
Don't wait too long.
Yeah. All right, well, I just want to say this, because yesterday I actually went on a bit of a junket.
Indeed.
I went on a junket. APAC sent me to Israel, and I've changed my position. No.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Co-working space in Israel.
No, it's not a co-working space.
I know.
This is actually pretty cool. It's Breather. So, I mean, I can think of 100 different uses in which I would have used this, and I could still even contemplate it now. Like, you know, we have some uncomfortable conversation we need to have in the office. There's no real place to do it. Right? I mean, if I have to take Michael aside and say, look, dude, you got to clean up after yourself in the, you know, in certain areas of the office, whatever. I might need to sit him down for an hour. What will I do? We have one space here.
I don't feel comfortable.
We have one space here. I can't do it here. Okay, so every time you need to book a meeting or any type of work event, you're faced with a bunch of different problems, right? A lot of people do offsite conferences. Where's the most convenient location? Will it feel professional? Will it have Wi-Fi? Breather has beautiful, inspiring work spaces for all of your offsites. Your team meetings, client meetings, or even individual work.
I definitely like wireless while we're having meetings so I can tweet.
Right, exactly. But, I mean, I was just thinking like this. I said to the guy, like, you know, when I was an actor, I would have to go, and particularly this is in L.A. too. I'm driving an hour across town, or here maybe I'm riding my bike or whatever it is, and I've got another audition an hour or two later in the same neighborhood. But I want to do some writing. I could go to a cafe, horrible, crappy Wi-Fi. This would have been great for me. And he's like, yeah, we get a lot of people like that. But they also have, like, therapists have their clients there. Instead of, like, renting a place that you're going to leave empty 50% of the time, you do it this way. Or companies have offsites.
So your dad said what to you? Anyways, I don't care.
This is the best part. You only pay for the time you need. You can do it on a month, a day, or even just an hour. There's no minimum commitments with Breather. They own all of their own spaces. They're always kept clean. It was fascinating, the system they have to get it clean afterwards. You get an excellent, consistent experience every time. Breather is in L.A., New York, San Francisco, Palo Alto, Boston, Chicago, D.C., Toronto, Montreal, and London. And they're growing. Google, Apple, Facebook employees apparently use Breather for their offsites and team meetings. And, you know, they have like the best offices that exist anyways. Don't overpay for space you don't need. Book a Breather space for the time you need it and spend hundreds, not thousands. And for some of the spaces, it's like reasonable enough for me to even do it. Try Breather right now, and you'll receive $100 off your first booking when you go to breather.com/majority.
100? Yeah, let's do it.
Breather.com/majority. I'm going to. That's $100 off your first booking when you go to breather.com/majority. Breather.com/majority. Check it out. I was actually genuinely impressed. I also tried this. Now, I've spoken about this before. I have term life insurance. And I bought more when Saul was born. I bought some when Milo was born. And I think I did 30-year with Milo and 20-year with Saul. Because I really did Saul like when he was like two or three. Basically, get them through college. God forbid something happens to me. They'll be taken care of. But do you have life insurance? If you don't, why not? It's usually, in my experience, it's too expensive, too much of a hassle, too intimidating. If you don't have life insurance, you're leaving people, particularly if you have a child.
It'll be like that scene in The Wire if you didn't have life insurance. Like they'd come to me for the new revenues from Majority Report, and I'd be like, we can't float you anymore.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Life insurance is a good idea to protect the ones around you. Where do you go to get the best prices on policy? PolicyGenius.com, the best online life insurance marketplace. Like I say, I already had term life insurance, but I went in as if I didn't. I went through the whole process, super easy, and the rate's cheaper than I have now. Because I bought it through a freaking insurance, you know, company, and they take a slice. And they take, apparently, a significantly bigger slice than Policy Genius. They have placed over $5 billion in life insurance for people like you. They have a very simpler, Policy Genius has a simple, user-friendly website. You shop, compare all the top-rated life insurance companies. They give you the best options. They have a licensed customer service team to help you find the best policy at the best price. And while you're there, you can check out their other insurance offerings, like pet insurance, Kelly. Go to PolicyGenius.com today to save over 40% off of other prices for life insurance. When life insurers compete for your business, you save money. That's Policy, P-O-L-I-C-Y, Genius, G-E-N-I-U-S.com. Zero jargon, zero sales pressure, zero hassle. Check it out. Don't wait. Go to PolicyGenius.com today. All right.
Just a quick question. So wait. If something bad were to happen to you, which would be awful, and I would cry and cry, Michael's...
You're not listed.
No.
I don't. Right, I'm just telling you. There's no upside.
What?
I'm saying there's no upside.
Let's get to Ben Carson.
Okay.
Come on. I need to do this.
I just wanted to make sure Michael's in charge. Michael is in charge of the majority report, he said?
Yes.
Michael thinks he's in charge of the majority.
Who's in charge?
Fine. I'm not saying.
Your sister?
Not saying.
I want her to be in charge.
All right. Well, we'll see. Yeah. All right.
I want the sister to be in charge, too.
Okay, great.
Not worried about it. I'm seeing a lot of upside here.
All right. So, Ben Carson apparently still works for the government. And
my luggage.
He is on Fox and Friends today, articulating that, yes, it's possible to be in the government for 6 months and still have no clue as to how politics or government or policy works. But here is Ben Carson on Fox and Friends. And when Ben Carson, what is the joke? When Ben Carson gets on Fox and Friends, the average IQ, what, does it go up or down? All right, but here...
I mean, between me and Brian Kilmeade, you're talking about a lot of wattage there.
Here we go.
Very hopeful that they're going to get it done and recognize that the system that we have in place right now, maybe people meant well. You know, I don't like to sit around and denigrate people. But the fact of the matter is we have millions of people who are losing care, who essentially don't have care because their premiums are so high, mm-hmm. The deductibles are so high, mm-hmm. it's like not even having insurance. Mm-hmm. So we've got to get back, take it out of the political realm. We have the ability to fix this.
We got to take it out of the political realm by voting on by the Senate repealing everything. And I mean,
that's
post
politics.
Look, you know, and I'll get into this in a bit, but this is the game, folks. And it's played by guys like Ben Carson, maybe unwittingly. frankly, because I have a feeling he does a lot of things unwittingly.
Play on.
But it's also played by the press. There was a story in the Times that somebody sent me, ostensibly about the battle that's happening in the Democratic Party. And the title of the piece in the New York Times is "Democrats in Split Screen. The base wants it all. The party wants to win." Now, let me just contemplate this for a moment. I don't know how you define base of a party, but I would imagine the primary electorate is indicative of it. The primary electorate voted for Hillary Clinton. Not all of it, but I don't know, a couple million more, 3 million maybe. If you look at the polling as to who identifies themselves as very liberal, it was split. Half of those people voted for Clinton, half of those people voted for Bernie Sanders. I don't know who the party is and who the base is here, but the idea that the base, whoever that is, ostensibly people, I guess, who are supportive of Bernie Sanders, doesn't want to win is a joke. The idea that the party wants to win is irrelevant because the party, including the base, has lost just about as much as you could lose and still be a party.
It's just like it's the easiest article to write in the world.
But here's the point.
You get a third-way quote. It's ridiculous.
But the point is that it's always politics when it's the other guy doing it. Right? It's the base. Well, the base of the party, actually, I don't know. I mean, I think the whole party wants to win. And it is an attempt, let me make it be more and more clear. This is being set up as if the base has an ideology, but the party doesn't. No, there's always an ideology. There's no one who engages in politics who does not have an ideology. They may pretend they don't. They may not think they do. But if you want to maintain the status quo, it's an ideology. You can pretend we're going to get politics out of healthcare by just allowing the private insurance market to deal with health insurance, but you're just pretending. It's all political. And that's another example.
You sound real arrogant, like an archaeologist.
Next time you hear somebody say politicizing something, just hear democratize instead and see how it sounds.
Oh, wow. That's so clever of you.
Actually,
that's the type of line I used to get candy on a date.
Did a pre-record where some of that comes into play. But now we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, an interview I did just about an hour ago with Matthew Karp.
Can I just say one more thing?
I
think we need to get politics out of Southern foreign policy. Slave trade did a lot for me as a physician.
Assistant professor of Princeton on the vast Southern Empire. Quick break. We'll be right back with this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. I'd like to welcome to the program Assistant Professor of History from Princeton University, author of The Vast Southern Empire, Matthew Karp. Matt, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
All right. So we were just talking before we started to record, but I don't know if this is a function of me or is it my imagination that there has been a, I don't know, significant amount, but there's been a lot of recently of new scholarship on on the years leading up to the Civil War, of the South in particular, leading up to the war, to the Civil War, and if that's the case, why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's it's maybe part of a larger sort of scholarly reevaluation of what we used to call the Old South, and we still do in some ways. And you know, thinking about what you know, why is it the Old South? It's the Old South because it was sort of defeated in the Civil War. You know, slavery was destroyed, and it rose anew as the New South after the war. But I think the tendency of the scholarship has been really pushing against the sort of idea of the of an antiquarian, old, backward-looking kind of pre-modern South, and towards. And this has been, I think, this has been happening for the past decade or so, and then maybe in the past couple years specifically, you've had some really big books by Sven Beckert and Ed Baptist and Walter Johnson that have sort of brought this maybe to the public consciousness. But I think, in a way, it's been happening for some time. And it, so you're asking why scholars are sort of revisiting slavery's place in you know, maybe the national economy or the world economy. I mean, in some ways, it's this is an echo of a controversy that happened in the 1970s in scholarship when there was a very controversial book published by Robert Fogel and Stanley Engerman called Time on the Cross, which made a bunch of arguments about how profitable slavery was instead of being a kind of backward institution, that it was profitable and, you know, highly productive. That kind of got shunted aside in a lot of ways. You know, I think it's a good question. I would say one interpretation is that people are now scholarship, I would say, often historical scholarship does have a real relationship to contemporary affairs. And I would say in our political moment where our you know, international political moment, even where capitalism seems to be delivering more rewards to the few and fewer rewards to the many, there's an instinct to sort of reevaluate its origins and its sources and think about the position of something like slavery, which traditionally we've tended to shunt aside from the history of capitalism, and think about the way in which in the South that kind of very inegalitarian form, to put it very mildly, of capitalism contributed to American economic growth. So I think that's one in a really broad sense, that's one root of the problem of the current direction of scholarship.
I mean, it's a I don't want to say over the top manifestation of just how labor can be exploited and how lucrative that can be. And I would also add on that side of the ledger, in terms of like the political economy aspect of it, but there's also, I think, a growing awareness of the durability of the mentality that was involved in subjugating African Americans. And at that time, you know, I mean, largely African, at least that first generation, but of Black people in this country. I think, you know, we've spoken to other people who haven't necessarily been talking about antebellum South, but have seen, who see the progression, that there is actually a continuum here. And in terms of largely, I think, America as a body politics perspective on Black people. And go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I think it's probably, you could look at, I think somebody like Ed Baptist would certainly, I mean, I guess you said you had him on the program,
yeah,
but has certainly sees his work as part of a long tradition and important sort of political intervention in pushing contemporary America to reckon with the centrality of slavery and of the you know, the exploitation of African Americans as really of the labor and the sort of violent, even, you know, for Baptist, sort of tortured, you know, torturous exploitation of African American labor is not just a sort of side story in American history, but really the sort of the main plot. You know, I guess I would say, though, at the same time, I you know, just to be sort of diligent in a scholarly sense, I do think that there's a lot of momentum behind this hypothesis of this sort of new interpretation of slavery as the kind of highest form of capitalism. At the same time, I think we should be cautious, because I think there are also good reasons to suspect that slavery wasn't as I think it's complicated, because the problem for me and where I stand in this landscape is interesting in terms of my book, which maybe we can talk about. But
yes.
Slavery, if slavery was the sort of engine that actually made capitalism go, as opposed to the engine that slaveholders thought made capitalism go, then why didn't capitalism collapse when slavery collapsed? And I think that's to reckon with the power of capitalism means it can't simply be reduced to slavery, because obviously, you know, the Civil War didn't end capitalism, you know. So it's complex.
And maybe your next book. I mean, because, you know, I wonder what, you know, something had to replace that free labor. I suspect in a lot of instances it was free labor that replaced it, but just came in a slightly or extremely discounted labor that came in the form of you know, exploiting former slaves. But I think your point is well taken. And I will say this too, as we because I do want to discuss your book now. One of the things that why that occurs to me in terms of like projecting it forward is because one of the main arguments that you make in the book is this notion of, and I feel like I've always had this perspective that slave owners were slightly embarrassed and were trying to sort of like hide behind America in a way. And you make the argument in this book that not only were they not trying to hide behind America, they were America in terms of what constituted leadership. And they were not only not trying to sort of be a little bit shy about it, they were trying to project this on not just the United States, but throughout the world. I mean, is that a fair statement, I think, of your thesis?
Yeah, no, and I like what you said, because I think actually that view of slavery as something that kind of, you know, had to be kept in the dark or spoken about in hushed tones, because of course you would, because why would you boast about slavery? It's so obviously brutal, is something that I think it corresponds to the way a lot of Americans still think about slavery. Or, you know, when we have arguments about the Civil War, was it slavery or states' rights? Well, you know, the whole argument that it was states' rights is a kind of form of presuming that nobody would trumpet slavery as the cause of the war, because even if it was secretly, they didn't want to talk about it. But what's amazing about this is how little evidence for that there is in the documents, because if somebody like Thomas Jefferson and some of the sort of founding father figures of the late 18th century, early 19th century did express a lot of agony about slavery without, in most cases, ever really doing anything about it in terms of their own slaves, the slaveholders who were in power before the Civil War, my characters, were much, much more upfront about things. And in fact, it's almost impossible to read a newspaper or a speech in Congress or any primary document relating to the politics of slavery in the 1850s without just noticing the absolutely unapologetic, muscular embrace of slavery. And specifically, as you said, slavery as really fundamental to American history, American economy, American society, and the United States in turn, also, as you said, as kind of the Western Hemisphere's leading champion of slavery and patron of other slave societies like the Spanish colony of Cuba and the Empire of Brazil, which all had very, you know, booming slave economies in the 1850s. But it was the United States, led by these proud and powerful slaveholding leaders from the South, that sort of understood itself to be the sort of strategic protector and kind of big brother of Western hemispheric slavery in before the Civil War.
And one of those central figures is John Calhoun, and he was very much about, and you write about a foreign policy of slavery. I mean, so you've got these people who perceive slavery as the engine of maybe American exceptionalism wasn't necessarily in vogue, but the essence of America in some ways, and this was going to be an engine that needed to be projected onto the rest of the world, and particularly in our hemisphere, I guess it was Cuba and and in South America in particular, I guess, in terms of
Central
sugar.
Central South America,
But yeah, talk about Calhoun's role and how also, I guess this is also the time to talk about what happens when Britain decides we're going to abolish slavery as of, I guess, early 1830s.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Calhoun is, to the extent that he's remembered, he is often depicted and seen as a sort of great defender of the South's sort of minority rights within the nation. You know, like he was responsible for South Carolina's attempt to sort of nullify tariff laws in the 1820s, the sort of state sovereignty as opposed to the power of the federal government in relation to the sort of the South's position with the Union. And Calhoun is the kind of prophet of the South being gradually encircled by a sort of more populous and more powerful North, a kind of prophet ultimately of Southern secession, although he died 10 years before the Civil War. But what's fascinating is Calhoun also served as the Secretary of State of the United States in the administration of John Tyler, and he wrote widely and thought very deeply about foreign affairs. And from that perspective, which is where my book approaches him, he was a much more confident, much less beleaguered, much more nationalistic rather than sectionalist leader who saw, in international terms, the United States as a slaveholding nation, but a nation whose economy was grounded in the exchange of goods from sort of tropical or subtropical places, slave staples like principally cotton, but also sugar, tobacco, rice, with the industrializing economies of the North in the United States and in Europe. And confronted, as you say, with British abolition, Britain abolished slavery in its West Indian colonies in the 1830s, Calhoun, even as he became more defensive domestically about the South's position in the Union, he became more aggressive internationally about harnessing American power to defend slavery against anti-slavery or abolitionist intrigues sponsored by Great Britain in the Caribbean, in Central America, in Brazil. It's really striking. Sectionalist at home, but absolutely the most muscular nationalist abroad.
Almost, there was almost like an early domino theory at that time.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, I do play with some Cold War metaphors there. You could talk about containment of slavery, and you can talk about, the idea of a domino theory. I think a lot of these Southern leaders, like Calhoun and some of his correspondents in and around the John Tyler administration in the 1840s, really feared that, okay, Great Britain has abolished slavery in its colonies, and it's going to come and now its economic interests are organized around eliminating the competition of enslaved societies across the hemisphere, because from their perspective, slavery generated much more efficient agricultural production than any other sort of form of labor. So Great Britain has now seen its in Jamaica, for instance, where former slaves kind of walked off the sugar plantation and set up their own kind of subsistence farming arrangements, Jamaican sugar production drops. So Britain all of a sudden needs to figure out where are we going to get the sugar from? How are we're sort of more dependent on these slave societies. And Calhoun and these guys and these Southerners fear that, okay, so Britain now is, in order to sort of protect its West Indian colonies, and has to break down the power of slavery everywhere. So they fear Britain's going to come after Cuban slavery, is going to come after Brazilian slavery, and in order to in a sense, crush the competition. And if they come after those other slave societies, then they're also going to come after the United States again. So a defeat to slavery anywhere in the Caribbean kind of changes the balance of power across the hemisphere between slavery and freedom. So there is a little bit of a domino theory mindset.
And we should also say, too, around this time, maybe slightly earlier, that when we talk about the foreign policy of the United States, we're also talking about our relationship with Texas, and things that we would consider the United States today, obviously.
Texas is so important.
Well, please, describe why.
Yeah. I think so. If you think about the world in 1843, say, in the Western Hemisphere, there are really four major independent slaveholding states. There's the United States, which is the largest, the richest, the most powerful. There's which principally grows cotton, although also rice, sugar, and tobacco. There's Cuba, which is becoming the major sugar exporter of the hemisphere. And there's Brazil, which is already, and also increasingly so, the largest sort of coffee exporter in the hemisphere. But the fourth largest slaveholding society in the whole hemisphere is the Independent Republic of Texas. And it's there that Southerners fear Britain, through its diplomats and merchants and other sorts of agents, are working to kind of convince the Texas government to potentially emancipate gradually its slaves in order for a guarantee of independence and favorable trade relations with Britain. And Texas is a burgeoning slave society. They're starting to grow cotton down there. They're a little bit of sugar too, but it's still much less settled than these other three slave societies. And I think there are a lot of motivations why American statesmen wanted Texas for security, for, you know, just national expansion, the idea of manifest destiny, et cetera, land speculation. But the major and the decisive reason, I think, is for these guys in the Tyler administration, which is the John Tyler is really the president who made the Texas Treaty go down through his Secretary of State, including John C. Calhoun. The main reason is they fear that Texas might be flipped to anti-slavery. They don't even want to take the risk. And it's the only way to sort of rebut British anti-slavery in Texas is to annex Texas as rapidly as possible to protect Texas from Mexico, which is also, I should say, an anti-slavery power. When you know, Santa Anna marches into Texas during the Texas Revolution, Southern slaveholders are saying Santa Anna is an abolitionist. So protecting Texas, which is kind of surrounded, you know, between Britain and the Caribbean and Mexico to the south, it's important to consolidate the power of slavery in Texas, the security of slave property in Texas, by annexing it to the United States. And that's what happens in 1845.
And just to be clear, the reason why Britain wants to project abolitionism, I guess, is because they want to level the playing field where theoretically all of its economic competitors will not have that advantage of slave labor.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that's how Southerners view it. They're extremely cynical about British abolition. It's mixed. I mean, I think the British commitment to anti-slavery is surely enhanced by the kind of economic imperative of sort of boosting its emancipated colonies against the sort of superior, the superior economic institution of slavery. That is, from the perspective of merchants and slaveholders. But I think it is a little bit more complicated. I would call British anti-slavery an ideological crusade that fused moral and economic and a kind of general political developmental ideas about labor and about human freedom into a sort of coherent anti-slavery ideology. So I think it's complicated. Certainly, though, I think Southerners saw it as completely cynical. And in fact, they believed, to sort of push the narrative forward a little bit, they believed that if Britain could understand that its economic interests actually lay not in opposing slavery, but in accepting the superiority of slavery, then Britain would be an ally to the South rather than a competitor. And by the 1850s, that's really they really thought that had happened, that Britain had sort of accepted slavery, that slavery wasn't going anywhere, and that actually they could make, British merchants and manufacturers could make more money just accepting slave labor rather than trying to break it down.
There's a quality of that dynamic which sort of makes me think of us and China on some level. I mean, you know, right? We could just, it's not, I don't know if it's fair to say it's full-on or not full-on slavery for a lot of laborers in China, but it's pretty darn close. And a lot of what we wear and a lot of what certainly American business exploits is that really low, low, low-cost labor. I mean, there's a similar dynamic, isn't there?
I mean, you could look at it that way in some ways. I mean, I still think I'm a little bit more old-fashioned, even though I think the new scholarship on slavery and capitalism has opened up a lot of doors, and it's very exciting. I'm a little bit more old-fashioned in regarding slavery as in chattel slavery,
right.
As in the owning of human property as something that is fundamentally different from low-wage labor, or even, to a degree, unfree labor, because, you know, even in a post-slavery society where laborers are still under the power of their bosses, they're not owned by their bosses. They can't be sold from town to town, you know, by their bosses. And nor is their does their labor represent the kind of largest form of capital of property in a given society. So I think there is something distinct about slave labor. At the same time, I think we should also be open to more capacious understandings of the way the problem of labor in international politics and economics. And yeah, I mean, I think the question of, you know, capitalism's kind of insistent search for cheap labor often with, you know, very little or zero regard for the conditions of that labor is absolutely one thread line that is continuous across these two centuries.
There's another thread line that is also seems to be continuous, and maybe hypocrisy is not the most accurate of words, but the perspective that the Southern slaveholding elite had in terms of federal power to state power. I mean, when you see that these the dynamic of, you know, don't tell us what to do with our slaves. However, we would like the federal government to ensure that we maintain slavery by annexing Texas is sort of, I don't know, there's, I don't know, Jeff Sessions is keeping up a longstanding tradition, I guess.
Just completely candid about my own sort of intellectual lineage in writing this, or the sort of the forces that contributed to writing this book. I mean, certainly in graduate school, the most important foreign policy question that was in the news at all times, you know, was the Iraq War. And the Iraq War, of course, perpetuated by, you know, an enormously expensive and there's no other word to describe the Iraq War except as a big government venture in terms of the resources and the powers, the resources expended and the powers implied by such a audacious undertaking, an ambitious one too, led, of course, though, by a party that professed fealty to small government and local authority and so on. So I think there's doing any kind of really vulgar direct comparisons, there's absolutely a tendency in American political life there are continuities between a kind of often a sort of self-identified conservative vision that, professes to favor small government and the light hand of government at home in order to sort of the minimum interference with the kind of power of existing elites at home is another way of putting small government at home, with the kind of very aggressive and ambitious and often expensive kind of deployment of federal power abroad. I think there is a through line there. Not to say that, you know, not to be too crude, but there's definitely a through line.
And I mean, just down to, like, you know, the idea of trumpeting states' rights, but not when it comes to things like, let's say, marijuana, or when it comes, you know, I mean, the
right.
There's a similar dynamic there, it seems to me, that's still playing out. You know, we're full on states' rights, except for in those areas where we're not.
Yeah. I mean, and that's why for me, I mean, and look, historians have been making this point for a long time that, I'm certainly not the first historian to sort of talk about how the South, was happy to sort of manipulate the power of the federal government, say, to enforce something like the Fugitive Slave Act, over and above the objections of northern states who had passed all sorts of ordinances demanding due process for people accused of being fugitive slaves. and the South just jammed the Fugitive Slave Act through Congress, which enhanced federal power and sort of insisted on the supremacy of the federal government in retrieving fugitives over and above northern state law. But I think, I mean, I guess I would say it, in a way it's not just about it's not just a sort of, I wouldn't call it a hypocrisy, actually. I think that's a word that we, or an idea that we often sort of jump to, that there's a, okay, there's a contradiction, that means there's a hypocrisy. I would say it's an ideology. I mean, I argue in the book that for these slaveholders, who I am more familiar with than contemporary leaders, but that in their view, there was nothing inconsistent about strengthening the federal, about relying on the federal government to support the institution of slavery, say in a fugitive slave law or in the annexation of Texas or in terms of expanding the U.S. Navy to defend slavery. All of those things flowed from their understanding that, you know, the Constitution was established to defend the security of property. And the federal government was naturally supreme in foreign affairs, and the states were supreme in local affairs, except when the states interfered with property rights, i.e., the fugitive slave law. So, from their perspective, I think I think we should grant them the sort of dignity of an ideology. Now, it's of course a slaveholding ideology that we find repugnant, but I think it was consistent in their minds.
Well, Matt Karp, fascinating book, This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy. Thank you so much for your time today. We will put a link to that at our blog at majority.fm. Thanks again.
Really happy to be here. Thank you, Sam.
I don't know why I keep calling it a blog. It's not, it's a website, but old habits die hard. Also,
blog sounds cooler.
We are in the midst of a redesign of the website, and it's going to look nice. It's going to be a little cleaner, a little more efficient, not as jumbled. If for some reason you have an idea on functionality that you think we may not have thought about, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. I mean, these are pretty straightforward things, so I imagine we've figured it out. But all right, we're going to take a break in a moment. But however, I wanted to just remind you, it is now almost the second week of June. Donald Trump has been president for almost six full months. Wow. And we all feel like we've aged years and years.
In my face, I did.
As you know, today Jeff Sessions is testifying in front of the Senate. There is rumors that Donald Trump wants to fire the special counsel, Robert Mueller.
I will not take questions from Kamala Harris.
The president does not appreciate the fact that Mueller has been hiring all of these experts in financial criminal law and mafia law, you know, criminal fighting, et cetera, et cetera. We also, of course, have a crisis in regards to Qatar. We also have a somewhat of a crisis relative to NATO, Article 5. We also are on the verge of destroying healthcare in this country, amongst other things. There's a whole raft of stories about how Donald Trump had issued all those signing statements and they were all for reviews that take 30 or 60 days or whatnot. And all the deadlines are being blown out. The president's own self-admitted travel ban, i.e. Muslim ban, has been struck down again in the courts. And he's still tweeting about that. Let's just look back to 8 years ago now and see where we were in terms of the big controversy on Fox News regarding President Obama. I mean, if you think it's bad now, just take a look at what was going on 8 years ago.
And finally tonight, as you all know, President Obama is a real man of the people. And yesterday he dropped by a popular Virginia restaurant to grab a burger with his pal Joe. Now, the Gateway Pundit blog pointed out that plain old ketchup, well, it didn't quite cut it for the president. Now, take a look at him ordering his burger with a very special condiment.
All right, I'm going to have your basic cheddar cheeseburger, medium well. I just want mustard, no ketchup. If you got like a spicy mustard or something like that, or a Dijon mustard, something like that.
All right, Dijon mustard? I think the president watched just a little bit too much television as a kid.
Pardon me, would you have any Grey Poupon?
You mean the mustard?
Yes, would you have any?
Would I? Or do I?
Both, actually.
All right, I hope you enjoyed that fancy burger, Mr. President.
Nothing complicated. Just some cheddar cheese, some...
horror.
Some Dijon mustard. And
the horror.
Make sure no white people handle my food.
The president putting that fancy Dijon non-American mustard on his hamburger.
Now I got to go to see Shakespeare.
Wow.
I got a prayer at 5. Then we have a African consciousness raising meeting. And then Pan-African reading of the vagina monologue. So if you could just put some Dijon mustard on that. Make sure white people don't touch my food. Yeah, all right, thanks. And remember, serve Joe second, not just because he's vice president, but because he's white.
Thank God we have put that behind us. And we now are just dealing with the more mundane aspects of trying to keep it together as a country.
I mean, you know, that's how things work in this country. It's a controversy if I have Dijon mustard, and it's cold, Shannon Hannity, if the president wants to have his daughter.
There you go. All right, folks, going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Remember, it is your support that keeps this program alive and on a daily basis. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com, wherein you can join the Majority Report at jointhemajorityreport.com. Pennies a day. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you bonus content. Some days maybe you want it. Some days maybe you don't. It will always be there on the days that we do have it.
See you in the fun half.
646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Also, if you buy your crap from Amazon or from Jet.com, check out our links at MajorityReportKickback.com. You will notice no difference, but we will get a kickback. Thus, MajorityReportKickback.com. See you in the fun half.
Every time I see her. bad.